You're listening to The Skeptic's Guide to the Universe, your escape to reality.
Hello and welcome to The Skeptic's Guide to the Universe. Today is Wednesday, February 16th, 2022, and this is your host, Stephen Novella. Joining me this week are Bob Novella.
Hey, everybody.
Kara Santa Maria.
Howdy.
Jay Novella.
Hey, guys.
And Evan Bernstein.
Good evening, folks.
How are you all? This lovely evening.
Doing well.
Doing well. Doing
keeping
well.
It together.
This is that part of February where you're like, is it going to be like another month of winter hell, or are we going to get an early spring?
Depends on the
and
groundhog.
It's all over the place.
Unless you live in LA.
As long as it's not slushy, you know, I don't mind it snowing and I don't mind it being like springtime. I just don't, I hate the slush.
Yeah.
I hate that so much. But listen, guys, I had a great week and a half because I started baking homemade bread.
Yeah.
I went a little late to the party.
Yeah. It's an adventure that I've been wanting to do for a while. And I just said, that's it. It's time. You know, some little checkbox got ticked in my head. And I just said, okay, this is it. I'm going to start doing it. So I got very, very lucky. And on the fourth recipe I tried, I hit the mother load. And I, last night, I made three loaves and they all came out amazing. It was like real, like rustic Italian styled bread. The flavor was incredible. And I've learned a lot, you know, just watching YouTube videos and reading about all sorts of things to do with yeast and flour. So I've just had so much fun. And I loved seeing my wife and a couple of people that we had over and my mother-in-law. Like, I loved seeing them eating the bread and their reaction to it because everyone was really excited. So I got the
nothing butt. Better than fresh baked bread, but bread is it's so tricky. Bad. I mean, I got pretty good at making the sourdough bread. I was doing that for a while, like the beginning of the pandemic. I do want to get back into it. I got a Dutch oven, so I want to use that to make some bread in. But you got to really stick to the recipe. You know,
yeah.
Baking's not like cooking. Cooking, you could fart around, do whatever you want, and experiment, whatever. Baking is like chemistry. You know, like the exact stoichiometry, you know, is critical.
Stoichiometry.
That did passed word see, of the week.
Yeah. Yeah. Did you guys see that meme going around that was like, Wordle is the sourdough of 2022? And like, okay. It makes such sense, but go back in time to like 2018. If somebody said that to you, you'd be like, what in the hell what are you talking
about? Today's word was hard. Caulk. Oops. Well, it'll be too
you're
late.
You're so going to have to. Oh, whatever. This will be like a week late,
I
right?
Know, it won't matter.
Yeah, it doesn't matter.
Oh, you
it
can't play prior words or can't go back into the.
No, it's one a day.
It's one a day.
I did hear that the New York Times, because you know New York Times bought it and they're folding it over. Some people are still on the old site. Mm-hmm. And they have a different word.
Whoa, ooh, double your word.
Yeah, like until it switches over for you, you're on a slight, you're on a different word. It's weird.
Yeah. Yeah.
Like that's not cool.
Well, you'd figure that they would just forward the old address to the new one. So anybody
think.
That, yeah, I don't know. It seems
yeah, but
very
like,
easy to do.
It's yeah, I don't get it.
Well, Jay, I can't wait. I mean, I had Jay's bread the first batch. And it was real. I really liked it. It had a nice crust. It was nice and chewy inside. You know, hearing him and his wife go off on this fourth batch was like the ultimate. I can't wait to taste it, Jay.
You gonna bring some to our show when you guys come to when we're all meeting up in New York?
Yeah, if I have any, you know, the thing is, it really does take a lot of time. Like, you know, this isn't. It's timely because there's a lot of like do this for 5 minutes and then wait an hour. You know what I mean? So you're kind of tied to the kitchen, which is fine. You know, like on a weekend when you're hanging out at home or whatever, it's no big deal. But yeah, right before we do those shows, if I have time, Kara, I'd be so happy to make you a loaf.
Well, Jay, you'll have to have a bake-off with our friend Bruce Press, who basically became an expert bread baker over the pandemic.
Yeah.
Oh, an expert.
Yeah, Bruce Bruce would destroy me, Steve. He's like cranking
out.
You're
missing
the
point.
But there'd be twice as much
bread. But the rest
of
us get to eat all the bread.
Exactly.
Either way,
yes.
Whoever wins or loses, we win.
With my bread, you know, my one loaf that I know how to do now.
Now, Jay, here's what you do. Show up with your own churned butter with your bread. That'll put you over the top.
Well, I lost my mind because I realized that my bread is absolutely the perfect companion to my meatballs, which, I mean, the two of them together, I don't know, I might travel in time if I eat them both at the same time. I love it.
Are any of you into any other rustic skills, like old-timey skills?
Oh, I have so many. You guys, I knit. Oh, God.
Yeah. Well, that's right.
I didn't say ing at the end. I know now to not say that I'm word knitting. In full. In front of
no, Kara.
I know a lot of like craft kind of things, yeah. You know, that are helpful in the post-apocalyptic world.
Mm-hmm. Mm. Well, I was going to make a stone wall, you know, by hand, but I got carpal tunnel instead. So that project got delayed indefinitely. Right.
Instead of a wall, you got a tunnel.
Last year, last October, I made a big graveyard. That's an old-timey skill for sure.
True. I garden. I guess that's an old-timey skill, but I like think a lot about doing it. It's just hard. I don't have the time to like really. I do the research. Like, yeah, this is going to take way more time than I have. Like, at one point, I'm like, I wonder how hard it is to make cheese. I think that would be fun, right? I mean, what's there to it? And it's, you know, so I learned all about how to make cheese. I was like, yeah, I'll do that sometime. And I never did it, you know, but.
Yeah.
What kind of cheese would you make? Like, would it be like cheese?
So the easiest cheese to make is the buffalo cheese, which is basically mozzarella, right? So it's you get just whole milk. It's overnight. Like the next day, you have mozz. You know, that's it. It's very easy. But in Parmesan, you have to age for like 6 months.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah, any hard cheese would probably be really hard to do.
You got to like keep it under a bowl in your refrigerator and just have to keep it moist and whatever. Any cheesemakers out there, let us know. If you're doing it at home as a hobby, let us know how it's going.
I once, for my birthday, my best friend and I emulated one of our favorite dishes from a very expensive, nice, like Michelin-starred restaurant here in LA. And we made our own sausage.
Yeah. Cool.
Like we got all the different types of meat and all the spices and put it through the meat grinder.
Did you grind the meat 3 times?
No.
No?
Twice.
Were we supposed to?
Yeah, yeah.
We ground it as many times as the recipe told us to grind it.
You don't understand that reference?
Anyone? I do not.
Anyone?
Shit.
Grind the meat 3 times?
No.
Ew. What? No.
That's from Sweeney Todd.
Oh, yeah.
Oh.
Right. Okay, gotta get all the toenails out of the meat. That's
what. Oh, my God.
So gross.
Do we have to keep up our rustic skills so that when the zombie apocalypse happens, we'll be able to do things like you know, bake our own bread and make our own cheese? All right, well, let's move on with our actual show. Jay, you're going to do, I guess this is a new segment. You're going to do a segment about something you learned today that is interesting.
Yeah, I'm going to talk about who was the first scientist. And of course, this is all up to opinion. You know, how do you define who the actual real first scientist was? I mean, you know, it's really just, it's up to you. But historians do tend to agree on at least a few people who kind of, you know, fit the mold here better than others. You know, the history of science, it goes back very, very far, depending on who you ask. But I think a really good place to put the first flag would probably be ancient Egypt, you know, around 3000 BCE, right? The Egyptians created a numbering system. They had a methodology to their healing practices that included examination and diagnosis and treatment and prognosis. Like, you know, they had some stuff going on, you know, that was noteworthy. But, you know, we're going to zoom down first to Aristotle quickly. He was born in 384 BC in Greece. You know, you probably have heard of him. He was the first to use logic, the first human to use logic. Think about that. He also, you know, was heavily into observing, right? He was he thought observation was very important. Inquiry and demonstration are also things that he is known for, and imagine being the first and only person, guys, to use, you know, methodological logic. Think about that. Like,
well, we don't know that he was the first person to use logic. He was the first person to develop a system of logic.
Right. Like, that's what I mean.
Operationalize it.
That's what I mean. Like,
yeah, but I just know that's what you mean. But just to be clear, because, you know, email.
Yeah, there were logical people prior to Aristotle. Sure. Yeah.
But just imagine, like, and we think we have it bad today. Like, imagine, like, I am the only person that uses logic. You're like, like, oh my God.
Some days it feels like that.
Yeah, right? So Aristotle took inspiration by observing the natural world. You know, he, at some point, it occurred to him, you know, that there is a seeming order to things, and he wanted to understand how it worked. Now, keep in mind, to be fair, most of what he concluded was wrong, straight up wrong. Like the things that he said, okay, so if this, then this, then this, and this is what I think, and this is how I think it works. Most of those ideas were just factually wrong because, you know, he just didn't have a lot of ways to gain real information or very useful information that could give him the, you know, a better truth than what he was thinking. But still, you know, it wasn't, that's really not the point here. His curiosity about the natural world led him to want to understand how our reality worked. And that's what's cool about what was going on in his head.
But again, I feel the need to defend Aristotle a little bit here. So you're correct in terms of his conclusions about how the natural, the physical world works.
Yeah.
His philosophy was like, he basically figured everything out like right at the beginning. You know what I mean? In terms of the big ideas of, of philosophy and thought, you know, they kind of worked out the basics, you know, right there at the very beginning of it all.
You know, Socrates came to the conclusion that thinking was really the only way to understand reality. Yeah. And Aristotle straight up was like, no, observation is the way to gain understanding about how the world worked. That's huge. Now, how well he did that, that's another thing to discuss.
Yeah.
So he was legitimately formulating theories based on observation. That is remarkably close to the scientific method today, right? I mean, it's a part of it. And it was there. He had the bones of it. And as a quick example, Aristotle observed that the mast of a ship was the first part of the ship that could be seen when it approached from the sea, right? So he was able to discover from that the earth was round. And he said it. Earth was round because of that observation. Damn, that's good. That's good, man. If I was with him, I'd be like, you're a smart guy, dude. You know what I mean? Like, very good. You know, me, of course, you know, thousands of years in the future with all the things that I got to learn. But the point here is that, you know, there's a good – you can make a very good argument that he was the first scientist, right? You know, not lab coat scientist, but at least scientific thinker. Another person who I thought I should mention, he's frequently considered the first scientist, and his name was Ibn al-Haytham. Have you guys heard of him? Of course you have. He was a Muslim Arab mathematician, astronomer, and a physicist. And he was born in 965 AD. So he extensively studied light and vision, which, you know, when you think about all the way back then, he is spending his time trying to figure out, like, how does light work? You know, how do we perceive things with our eyes? You know, these are pretty profound questions. He's also thought to have invented the camera obscura as well as the pinhole camera. And if you're interested, look those up and read about them because there's quite a bit of information about those. He conducted legitimate experiments with candles and described how an image is formed by rays of light. Rays of light? That's cool as hell, traveling in straight lines. That's real legit right there. And he was the first person to develop a hypothesis, and then he tested it with verifiable experiments. So, you know, between those two, they were definitely people who pushed the ball forward. Like, you know, the truth is this, guys. It took thousands of people, you know, an undetermined amount of number of people, but a lot of people to slowly push the concept of science forward, you know, enough to take the form that we understand it today. But, you know, there was landmark people in there that came up with very important concepts on their own. And these two people were definitely in that list. But there's more moments in time and people that were significant, which is fun to read. One more quick fun thing, Steve, if you don't mind.
Go right ahead.
For your information, the term scientist dates back to only 1834. A philosopher named William Whewell, right? Whewell, came up with the word to include all practitioners of the ever expanding fields of science.
What was science called before then?
Natural philosophy.
Yeah, but I think science is still older than what year did you say scientist was dubbed?
1834.
Yeah, science as a word is definitely older than 1834.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, because he took that word and came and put tist on the end of it, you know?
We don't know who coined the term science, but William Whewell was the first one to coin the term scientist.
Yeah, science is probably from the mid-14th century. And yeah, before that, it was natural philosophy. Before that, it was philosophy, just like generally philosophy.
So it was just part of philosophy.
Yeah, which is why you still get a PhD in science.
Mm-hmm. And before that, it was religion.
Before that, it was just looking around.
Well, religion and science were pretty much one and the same. It was
all authority.
It was good science, but that's what it was.
All right, we're going to start off the news segment with a pair of astronomy news items. Bob, you're going to start us off by talking about Psyche, which is an asteroid, and what's it made of?
So, guys, famous asteroid 16 Psyche has been reevaluated in terms of its composition, and future belters the world over are in tears. So what the hell am I talking about? Well, I'll tell you. This is based on a study. This is based on a study published in Geophysical Research Letters, and it's a classic example of how science can lead to disappointment no matter how much closer it gets you to the truth. It happens. Psyche in this context isn't that thing in your head that gets shattered by horrible science news. It's also not Psyche, the Greek goddess of the soul who married Eros, also known as Cupid. The Psyche I'm going to talk about was named after this classical Greek figure and is what I'm sure she'd consider an insult since it's a Class M asteroid. Now, this doesn't follow the Star Trek convention of Class M planets being habitable. Come on, it's an asteroid. Of course it's not habitable, but it's Class M. And in here, it means that it has a higher proportion of metals. I guess perhaps the M stands for metal. Makes sense. Like iron and nickel, it has more of those metals than most asteroids, which contain mostly the more pedestrian silicate rocks. Its diameter is 220 kilometers, 140 miles. Big, pretty damn, the biggest Class M asteroid out there. And basically, you know, about the size of the distance between Los Angeles and San Diego, Kara. That was for you.
Wow, that's really big.
Yeah. And now, M-class specifically refers to the spectra of an asteroid. That's what it's dealing with. And in this case, it shows that there's a lot of exposed metals on the surface. Now, based on that, astronomers made reasonable extrapolations, you know, based on the sheer immensity of this thing. If the surface is metal, then, you know, it's pretty much mostly metal, probably. So they were saying things like, oh, it's 90 to 95% metal, making it the core of a planetesimal or a protoplanet, a very early planet from billions of years ago. So that would have to mean then that it was likely produced from a titanic collision with another object that literally ripped away the crust and mantle, leaving just this exposed core of a planet. Now imagine that, the exposed core of a planet from billions of years ago. You know, the potential to learn about the early solar system and fill in a lot of blanks is huge, which is part of the reason why there was so much interest in this. But from an avaricious point of view, think about it, a 220-kilometer block of mostly iron, but also nickel, platinum, and gold is a treasure pretty much beyond imagining. This could make everyone on Earth a billionaire, which realistically, of course, wouldn't happen since the gold market would collapse. We'd have major financial instability and lots of other bad things. But, you know, but the point remains, the sheer quantity of wealth that we're talking about. Forbes put Psyche's worth at 10, wait for it, $10 quintillion. $10 quintillion. That's 10 billion billion, or it's 10 times a million cubed. Or it's a hundredth of a sextillion, and I'll stop now.
Or it's the amount of money Elon Musk makes in a month.
Right. Let's put it in this perspective then, Kara. The global economy is 94 trillion. So Psyche would be worth about 106,000 times the global economy.
That's insane.
So that's exciting, right? I mean, NASA even created a mission specifically to visit Psyche, this mysterious asteroid with so much metal in it. And, it's leaving later this year. But Psyche gives us mixed signals, much like when Jay is on a diet and he's got 10 meatballs within easy reach.
It's pyrite. It's not real gold.
So if you measure its mass, it's all about mass and density in this story. If you measure its mass and density based on its gravitational tug on nearby objects, it doesn't act like a gargantuan lump of metal. If it were mostly metal still, it would have to be about 50% porous. 50% porous, which I guess is not impossible. So the good scientists, like all good scientists, or most of them, they ran models. And so these models were based on the known thermal properties of metallic iron, right? You'd kind of need to know that to make these models work. And also what we knew about the early solar system. And so as the model of Psyche evolved over time in the model, they determined that for such a lump to remain porous, it would have to cool down to below 800 Kelvin fairly quickly. Otherwise, right? Imagine if it cools down too slowly, then that the weight, the sheer weight and gravitational pull of this, of all that metal, this porous, malleable metal would collapse into itself. So bottom line, there's no way Psyche cooled that fast. so that it could remain porous, even if the porosity was induced later in life, later down the road by an impact, for example. It can't be that porous. So then, what do we got left now? So the only reasonable option then is, and the conclusion of the paper, is that Psyche has a metallic surface, right? Because it's class M. It's got the, you know, the spectrum says that this is a metal surface. But the core itself, probably a metal as well, but the interior, the mantle, if you will, is gotta be normal silicate rock, like most other asteroids, and that is what's driving its density down. It's that. So now I think you appreciate why future belters working in our main asteroid belt, mining for precious metals are very, very upset because, you know, there's still probably a lot of metal out there, even just on Psyche, but nowhere near the amount that people have been talking about literally for years and would make these, you know, hundreds of belters trillionaires in the future. But there's more because this all begs the question, right? Why is the surface metal and the mantle is not? How did that? Oh, I dropped a robot. Okay, never mind. Moving forward.
That was not a non sequitur either.
So why? So then how did that happen? That's kind of, you got a metal shell. What's going on? So one possibility is ferrovolcanism. Yes, iron spewing volcanoes. So how cool is that? So we know of two volcano types. There's silicate volcanism, and that's what we see all over the Earth and on other planets and on other moons. Silicates, rocks, right? Just magma spewing out. Then there's cryovolcanism, and we see that on Enceladus and Triton.
Nice.
And maybe Europa. And that's essentially magmas made of liquids and gases that would be otherwise frozen on the surface of the moon that we see this on. Okay, that's cryovolcanism. Now, ferrovolcanism has never been observed, but it seems like it probably has happened based on the surfaces of other bodies in the solar system. But you'd have flowing liquid metal instead of the more viscous rocky magma, right? Theoretically, that could occur on all metal worlds or hybrid metal rocky worlds like 16 Psyche. How cool is that? Ferrovolcanism. Never heard of that.
Something
that's fascinating.
Something that small can have a volcanic feature to it?
Yeah, I mean, it's dense. It's big enough. And so sure. I mean, yeah, I see what you mean, that it doesn't seem like there'd be enough. I mean, if this was the core of a planet, then this was under a hell of a lot of pressure for a hell of a long period of time before that even happened. So that heat just doesn't go away. So now the future of Psyche is now essentially in the hands of its NASA mission, which will launch this year and arrive in 2026. And of course, you know, we probably won't find a place reminiscent of that very cool Disney movie called Treasure Planet. Seriously, check it out. It's the best fusion of pirate and science fiction that I've ever seen. Fun animated movie. But I'm sure that 16 Psyche is going to offer many, many surprises, and I really can't wait to see what happens when we get up close. Speaking, though, of science fiction, and I will end with this. Now, remember I said that the only reasonable option for a low-density asteroid was that it had lower-density rock inside? There's another slightly less reasonable possibility that I would like to explore. I coincidentally finished a very, very cool short story last night called Owner Space by Neil Asher. Owner Space. Really cool. He's got a few books riffing off of that too, which I recommend. So in the story, in it was a moon that wasn't as dense as it should have been. Similar to Psyche, right? In the end, it's revealed to be a mind-bogglingly massive ship created by some superhuman whose name is the owner. So, NASA, maybe when NASA gets there, I'm just saying. That's it. Just saying.
What are you saying?
Just saying.
So, what's the new estimate of Psyche's value?
Oh, people I think are just too depressed to calculate it. It's certainly not going to be 10 quintillion. But it could be many, many trillions or maybe even low quadrillions. I don't know. But this was the crown jewel, though. You know, I've seen these beautiful, you know, artist interpretations of what Psyche looks like. And I don't know who drew his impression of Psyche, but they drew an amazing looking asteroid, really funky and weird too, because of all the metals that are on the surface. It's beautiful, and people have been talking about this for years about how, you know, can you imagine an asteroid that's all metal, and now it's just like, oh, It's just, you know, it's just the surface, really, and probably not the interior, and it's not worth 10 quadrillion. It's just kind of a bummer. I mean, because that industry will happen in the future, right? I mean, that's almost guaranteed that we will have an industry in the asteroid belt that will have access to crazy amounts, like economy-ending amounts of materials like gold and platinum and iron.
Man, we are so stupid.
Well, I mean,
so stupid.
I mean, if you have the resources and the wherewithal to get there and mine it and then bring it, you know, you wouldn't be stupid about it. You would bring it back judiciously. You'd bring it back in small amounts and you wouldn't flood the market, especially with gold and platinum. The iron's a different story. I mean, you can come back. You know, you could still damage the economy if you came back with 10 mountains worth of
like all the
of
diamonds
iron.
They've mined.
But
they're
the iron,
really
iron, I mean, we need iron for steel, and steel is still the man, you know, steel is still it.
Right, Steve, with our swords?
Absolutely.
I looked up a picture of the asteroid Psyche. All these pictures, you know what they have in common? It's from the perspective of the two craters, which look like two eyes and a face. I mean, we're so human when it comes to some things.
Yeah,
it's like obvious.
Cool.
but really, I mean, you know, we couldn't see it from a different side. No, we have to have the side which looks so it looks like a face.
And if you looked at what we actually can see, it's like this blurry blob. That's totally, I mean, it's all made up, all those details. And when I first saw it, I thought, oh, man, that's a pretty damn good close-up. How do we get that?
Bob, as we get closer, what if it's more like a human skull in features?
Oh, there was a skull asteroid out there.
Yeah, that was cool.
And from under certain lighting, from a certain angle, it looked absolutely, you know, like the top of a skull. And it was so, such an interesting
picture.
It's
very good. But you're right. I mean, it's incredibly... It even has like the ridge down the middle of the nose. Yeah.
Yeah, it was really cool. But of course, you know, just a trick of the light, really. Just like the face on Mars.
All right. What do you guys think of this headline? This comes from BBC News, from the science correspondent at BBC.
Oh.
Life could exist on planet orbiting white dwarf star. What do you think about that?
Life could exist on planet orbiting white dwarf star. That's a big claim.
Mm-hmm. Are you saying that this is a habitable zone?
Yeah, if it's tidally locked, it could be in the far side or
habitable zone.
So habitable. I love that word.
Habitable. Yeah, the habitable, the Goldilocks zone. So
yeah, the Goldilocks.
I think it's BS. But here's what they did find: astronomers have found a possible planet orbiting a white dwarf star. What's a white dwarf star? That is a stellar remnant. Yeah, it is the core of a medium-sized star, a star like our own sun. After it throws off its outer layers, right? So our sun is going to expand to the point where it takes up the beyond the orbit of Mars, right?
Yes. Yeah, and we'll be in trouble.
It'll expand. Yeah, so we'll be burned crisp at that point. It'll be like a red giant, like Betelgeuse is today. This is the normal life cycle of a star. And then after that, you know, as it's going through its fuel, burning hydrogen to helium and then helium into heavier elements, blah, 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 then it gets to the point where it either gets to iron, which is the last thing it can get to. You can't go beyond that. Or it gets to however heavy the heaviest element it can fuse is based on its mass, right? The more mass, the heavier elements that you can fuse. When it can no longer fuse stuff, there's nothing to keep the star propped up. The core will collapse. The outer layers will fluff off. If it's big enough, it'll supernova. Our star is not big enough to do that. And then depending on the size of the core left behind, it'll either be a white dwarf. Beyond a certain limit, it'll collapse into a neutron star. Beyond a certain limit, and that will collapse into a black hole, right? A white dwarf is not burning fuel, and it's not producing energy. It's just a glowing ember of the star that it was a part of. And,
so it's considered a dead star?
Well, it's a stellar remnant. They don't use the term dead. It's still very hot, though.
Right. Yeah, Kara, just like a neutron star and black hole are, you could say that they're dead stars.
Yeah, they're dead stars.
In a sense,
that's
right.
That's what I was saying. They're no longer doing that furnace.
Yeah, they're not
activity.
Fusing,
yeah, they're
really.
They're not burning. Yeah. They're not fusing.
That major fusion, anyway.
Yeah, nothing's
happening. Essentially, next to nothing.
All right. So when a white dwarf initially forms, it's going to be around, it's going to be pretty hot, though. It's going to have a temperature of about 100,000 Kelvins. That's hotter than, you know, the surface of our sun, right? Which is a little bit less than 6,000 Kelvin. Because it's not in any kind of equilibrium, it's just cooling, right? So it's going to, from that point, it's going to cool. After about 2 billion years, that 100,000 Kelvin will cool to about 8,000 Kelvin. Still hot. Still, yeah, you know, hotter than, you know, like our sun. But it will continue to cool from there, you know. The cooling slows because, you know, the hotter it is, the more heat you radiate away, and so the faster you cool. There's a question of how long will it take until it cools down all the way, like to the background radiation. So it'll get close in 15 to 20 billion years, but getting all the way down could take quadrillions of years because that has a long, 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 long tail, and there may be quantum effects going on that are producing a little bit of heat, and the universe is cooling too, so it's kind of a little bit of a race, you know. So
quadrillions,
it takes longer. It could support life.
It takes longer than the age of the universe for a white dwarf to cool to that point. So there aren't any white dwarfs that have cooled that far. When the white dwarf cools to the point where it's no longer visible, we call it a black dwarf. But, you know, there aren't any out there yet. But there,
I thought it was a brown dwarf. What's a brown dwarf?
That's, there are brown dwarfs.
We have brown dwarfs.
Oh, that's
brown
a planet. That's a
yeah, it's a big, failed
big,
star.
Big
yeah.
planet, right. Small.
Okay. Just very confusing naming system.
Yeah, black dwarf is
get used to it.
Yeah, the brown dwarf is not quite big enough to ever be a star. This is a black dwarf. It's a white dwarf that's cooled to the point where it's no longer visible. So, yeah, so it has a habitable zone, but there's a couple of problems here. That habitable zone is close to the star, close to the white dwarf.
Tidal force is nasty.
Like Mercury.
Well, there's two problems. One is, like any small, dim object, it's so close that you would probably, any planet that's close enough to be in the habitable zone would be tidally locked. That's not a deal killer.
You could just have life on half the planet.
Yeah,
or just a ring around the planet. Yeah.
In the terminus, or in also a worldwide
interior
ocean and atmosphere could actually very effectively redistribute heat, and it actually wouldn't be as bad as you would think. Probably you wouldn't want to be on the point directly under the sun, or directly opposite, but there could be a pretty sizable, you know, reasonable, you know, livable zone there.
So and the again, planet itself has a Goldilocks zone.
Yeah, exactly. So from that perspective, and that's this perspective that they're talking about, it's in the Goldilocks zone, and what do we consider that? That's the range at which you could have liquid water on the surface. And of course, that depends on your atmosphere, because the more carbon and, you know, greenhouse gases you have, the farther away you could be and still be in, you know, in the habitable zone. It's whatever. There's sort of a maximum, you know, range you could have for any star. But the problem comes from imagining a scenario in which you have a planet orbiting a white dwarf in the habitable zone that has life. Because first of all, remember what I said, before that star turned into a white dwarf, it would have been a red giant. So any planets close to it, any planets in the habitable zone would have been inside the red giant, you know, that it was before it died. And so it would have been burned to a crisp. No life would have survived that transition.
Yeah, but after that, it could have started. Abiogenesis could have started. I mean, we only need, a couple billion years.
But the thing is, you need a couple of billion years, right? Uh-huh. In those couple of billion years,
planetary migration,
the habitable zone will have massively moved.
Shifted.
Right? Mm. That planet would not be in the habitable zone for 2 billion years. The habitable zone will move quickly through the planetary orbit, you know, as the white dwarf cools. So, you know, maybe it would have a half a billion years or whatever. So one other scenario is that the planet maybe migrated in.
Yeah.
You know, so maybe the planet was farther out.
Hot Jupiter.
It was a frozen world, you know, a moon or whatever, a frozen planet that was in the outer reach of the solar system. And then with all this going on, the orbits were disrupted and one of the small planets spiraled into the habitable zone where it melted and became, you know, had liquid water on the surface and then life evolved.
But remember, guys, when Steve says habitable zone, that's life as we know it.
There
could be chemosynthetic life that has a huge habitable zone.
Yeah, but that's all bets are off with that. or why? It could why? Be we have subsurface, it on, why? We have subsurface it on water. Earth. Because then we're not, because that's not what we're talking about. We're talking, as I said, by definition, this Goldilocks or habitable zone that we're talking about is liquid water on the surface. If you assume life that doesn't require that, then again, as I said, all bets are off. Then we're not even talking about
it. Right. You know. Just keep that in mind, though. It's not like, oh, you can't be, there can't be any life.
Bob, don't move the goalposts.
Yeah, I mean, you're talking about bacterial life, right, Bob? That type of life?
Well, Jay, we don't know. There could be critters in the oceans of Europa. That's not technically in our habitable zone. You can't have liquid water on the surface of Europa, but because it's next to a gas giant and because it could have liquid water under the surface, there could be life there. But, you know, again, it would have to be chemosynthetic because it wouldn't be getting any light. But we're putting all of that aside, and we're just saying Earth life that requires liquid water.
Yeah.
And
with such chauvinists.
Yeah, if you take that criteria, that's what they're talking about in this article. This planet is in that habitable zone. But the again, this is even assuming this planet exists. We'll talk about that in a second.
But Steve, do they mention Cthulhu? Because Cthulhu could live anywhere.
Yeah, that's true. So the thing is, it's just there's no scenario where it's likely that a planet is going to be in a white dwarf's habitable zone for any length of time because it's such a moving target because the star is the white dwarf is constantly cooling. And initially it's cooling, you know, from a stellar system, a life evolving perspective fairly quickly. Again, you go from 100,000 Kelvin to 8,000 Kelvin in 2 billion years. Yeah. That's a massive difference. That's a complete, there's no planet that's going to just stay in that habitable zone throughout those 2 billion years. And then it gets cooler from there. And so you're going to be outside, you know, you're going to be, you know, on the other side of the habitable zone. You're going to freeze in another half a million years or whatever. So I guess it's possible that if we like were able to explore that planet, we would find frozen fossils of life that briefly flourished in its brief sojourn through that habitable zone before the world froze.
Cool.
Yeah, but it's not like there's going to be a thriving ecosystem there. You could think about, well, maybe an alien civilization settled that world because it was in its habitable zone. They don't care, like, oh, in 10 million years, this planet's going to freeze. Who cares? 10 million years? Yeah, okay. We'll live here for a couple of million years and then we'll move on, right?
We'll just shrug it off and not even care.
Yeah, you don't worry about the millions and billions of years. So from that perspective, I don't think there'd be enough time for life to evolve, but you know, it may be settled. But then we're looking for techno-signatures, right? Then we're talking about a civilization that could probably terraform and settle an alien world. You know, also, there's a couple other problems, though. One big problem is, what kind of light is that star putting out? And it depends on what temperature it is, right? It's putting out, you know, the frequency of light based on temperature, but
white
it's also
dwarf
putting
light.
Out, they tend to put out a lot of ultraviolet and x-rays.
Ooh.
So,
that's
it's
healthy
not,
for life.
Not, yeah. Well, so, I guess,
not life
guess
as we know it.
Life could evolve to tolerate that, you know, or there might be some super ozone around the planet or whatever.
Or maybe it just like evolves super fast because of all the mutations.
Yeah, right. Or they live in an ocean and they won't care about UV if they live in the ocean.
Yeah. But if you were a surface dwelling, you know, civilization, why would you go there? You know what I mean?
For the
unless
tans?
Some strategic importance, but then you probably build shelters and stuff. So just wouldn't be a great place for life, you know, for all of those reasons. But and emphasizing that in the article, I thought was a huge red herring. Like that's not what's cool about this news item. It's just that this would be only the second planet we've discovered around a white dwarf. And it's just interesting that white dwarfs can have planets around them. It's interesting that one would be so close to it, because where did it come from? Why wasn't it completely destroyed when in the red giant phase? So it probably was captured or migrated in or whatever. But here's the thing. The evidence for this is, it's interesting, but it's not direct. Like this is not like transit method or anything. The astronomers were looking at the movement of other things orbiting the white dwarf, and their orbits were more stable than they should have been, than the models predicted that they would be. And that stability could be explained if there were a planet in a close orbit around the white dwarf. So it's a bit removed, you know, it's a bit inferential.
But even if it's true, like that's, as you mentioned, interesting in and of itself. Like, why? I mean, I feel like this is just another example of science editors or science writers underestimating the interest level, the curiosity, the intelligence of the reader.
Yeah.
They're like, we have to make something else up. Otherwise, people won't even care.
Right. Yeah. They have to play the life angle. And it's not really a very plausible angle. And it gives people the wrong impression because there's so much. And figuring out, answering the question, what are the prospects for life around a white dwarf? You learn a lot about white dwarfs and the lifetime, you know, the life cycle of a white dwarf. And there's a lot of good reasons why it wouldn't be a great candidate for life.
And they could even write it that way.
Yeah.
Why this potential planet probably doesn't harbor life.
Yeah.
And then you get to learn about it all.
Right, right. But it's still cool. You know, it might be planets around white dwarfs. It does. And every time this comes up, it's good to think about, like, what are the probabilities for planets we would find comfortable, you know, out there in the galaxy, out there in the universe. And I know we've talked previously about there are several Goldilocks zones, right? There is around any individual star, but also there's a Goldilocks zone in the galaxy. You want to be far enough out where you're not going to be constantly bombarded with gamma ray bursts, but not so far out that you don't have enough metallicity to form, you know, complex organisms. So there's kind of a zone in the Milky Way where stars are most likely to have planets that could form life.
Yeah, I mean, it sounds like there's also a temporal Goldilocks zone that this very story illustrates.
Totally. And so the temporal one, so that, and we talked about this, but I'll
early universe you. Population.
Well,
one
in terms
stars.
Of like in terms of which kinds of stars, you know, if we had a survey of all the life out there, what would be the most common type of star that has life out there?
Population three, right?
Yeah, well, wouldn't want to be a first generation star because then you don't have any metals, right? You have to form out of the cloud of an older star. But I'm talking about like how massive the stars. The more massive the star, the hotter they burn, but the shorter
they live.
So you have the
like a few hundred million years.
Yeah. Right, the big ones, the blue ones, a few hundred million years, nope, those are not good candidates for life. At the other end of the spectrum, we have the red dwarfs, and they last the longest. They might last for trillions of years. So you think, okay, well, you know, then most stars are red dwarfs.
Yeah.
And they're stable for a really long period of time. So maybe they have most of the life. Problem is they're unstable early on in their lives, and they probably would blast the atmosphere away from any planets close enough to be in their habitable zone. Also, their habitable zone will probably be tidally locked, but again, not a deal killer, as we said, but not ideal. But then we get back to, well, maybe planets migrate in after their angry phase when they've settled down. So there's still a possibility there, but still, they're not ideal. It's possible. Astronomers go back and forth. Yellow stars like ours, they're solid. They're good. They last 10 billion years or so, and you know, they have a generous habitable zone. But the sweet spot is probably the orange stars because there are many more of them than yellow stars. They live much longer, like 20 to 50 billion years. And so therefore there'll be more of them, right? Because they have a longer lifespan. So that's probably most of the life out there lives on planets around orange stars.
So we're minorities?
We might be in the minority by having a yellow sun.
Hmm. Cool.
Yeah, cool. So that's it. Lots of Goldilocks zones in terms of like where are we most likely to find life. I wouldn't waste a lot of time looking around white dwarfs for planets with life.
No.
The numbers don't add up. All right, Evan, tell us about this crashing flock of birds. Is this real?
Ooh, I saw this video.
I saw it too.
Everybody has finally seen it. Yes.
Yeah.
Yeah. I'm going to describe it as an upsetting video. I don't think that's right. Too far afoul. Oh, can't say that either.
Oh, I can't know how many are there.
All right. All right. I had to get one out of the way. Now it's out of my system. All right. So, yeah.
I doubt that.
Now, this video hit the internet last week. The video is a static shot, a surveillance camera of some sort, capturing a street and homes in the early morning hours of daylight. And it was recorded on February 7, 2022 in the, oh boy, here I go, pronouncing words in Mexico that I'm sure I'm going to botch. All right. The Alvaro Obregón neighborhood of Ciudad Cuauhtemoc, a city in the west central part of the Mexican state of Chihuahua.
Chihuahua?
Chihuahua. Chihuahua is Chihuahua.
It's so funny because to me it's by far the easiest because it's a completely phonetic language.
Yeah. Once you get the rhythm and the where the accent's going. Yeah.
Like they don't even have spelling bees after something like third or fourth grade because it's like it's too easy.
It's so easy. Okay, the Alvaro Obregón neighborhood of Ciudad Cuauhtémoc.
Cuauhtémoc.
That one's harder because that might be like
probably
an Aztec word.
Yeah.
Cuauhtémoc, a city in the west central part of the Mexican state of Chihuahua. Yeah.
What Kara said and what I failed to properly pronounce. Thank you, Kara. Appreciate the assist there. All right, so you've got this static shot. Nothing's happening in the video until suddenly hundreds, perhaps over 1,000 birds plummet into the frame and crash to the ground, hitting the houses, hitting the street, hitting the sidewalk. To me, because I'm trying to describe this video on an audio podcast, which is a challenge. But, for those of you who want to see it, you can go look at it. But for me, it looks like someone had what would be a gigantic bucket of birds the size of two houses and suddenly dumped them onto the ground like water thrown from a bucket. It has that sort of suddenness and splashing effect to it. Hopefully I described that pretty decently.
To me, it looked like a murmuration that started to kind of lose course.
It was totally a murmuration. Yeah,
and it's almost like they flew into the ground.
Yeah, they
probably didn't.
What were they
murmuring? Fell.
They flew. You're right, Kara. It was a murmuration that flew into the ground.
That's what it looks like. For sure, that's what it looks like. Like a bird crash.
That's right.
Yeah.
A big bird crash.
But you see, when it first came out, and I know this news report is being finally carried sort of on all of the mainstream news outlets now, today and yesterday primarily. But the video came out again on February 7th, and there was a report made by a local news organization there that day. And I'll talk about that in just a second. But again, you can look at the video yourself. Now, most of the birds managed to survive and they flew off. However, there were many dozens of birds, maybe 100 or so, that did not survive. You can still just see their bodies on the ground there. And like I said, it's been making the rounds in the broader news. So after the video started to circulate last week, there was, correctly so, speculation as to whether or not this was authentic. And that was what Steve was asking at the top of this news item. Now, it was able to be authenticated pretty quickly. Like I said, a local news organization came out to the scene and ran the first story about it only hours after it actually happened. And there were witnesses that they had, and police were there. And so it was verified that this did happen. The name of the paper is El Heraldo, which is the Herald, I will assume, not Geraldo Rivera, right? H-E-R-A-L-D-O, Herald. But here's their headline to their story. Again, this is the first report. Migratory birds affected by cold and pollution. That's the headline. And here's how parts of it read. According to local media reports, police investigated the scene and found hundreds of dead birds that had been migrating south from Canada. The birds appear to be yellow-headed blackbirds, or Xanocephalus. I'm sorry, Xanthocephalus. You ever heard of those, Steve? Yellow-headed blackbirds?
Yeah. I love it when birds are named that way. Like they're named, it's just a description of what they are. Yeah, they're yellow-headed blackbirds. That's exactly what they are. And it always reminds you, so when, my now older daughter who's out of college, but when she was young, like 4, 5, 6, we were into birding together. And great way to teach kids science, by the way. And so she figured out, at a young age that this was a pattern, that a lot of birds are named in a descriptive fashion. So we saw a bird at the feeder and I asked her what the name was. And she didn't know what it was, but she followed the convention. She was like, it's a two-winged, one-beaked brown bird.
I like that.
Was she right?
Perfect. Very reasonable.
Well, that wasn't the name of the bird, but that was an accurate description, yeah.
The reporters on the scene who were there, they captured the thoughts from a veterinarian who was called to the scene, I believe came in with the authorities and when the police arrived. And according to that veterinarian, his opinion was that these migrating birds were suffering from high levels of air pollution in the region due to the use of wood-burning heaters, agrochemicals, and even low temperatures. So temperature also apparently played a role. And another reason is that they were reportedly, all perched on power lines, or many of them were, and there was an overload that affected them and sending them crashing to the ground. But then they said, and again, this is all from this news article, They end with this. However, it's not possible to determine exactly what happened to the birds. All right, I get it. This is a local paper. You know, they're first on the scene, and they had to rush something into their system sort of to lay claim to be the ones who reported it first. But it also explains, I think, why news reporters should be doing kind of the exact opposite of what they did. You don't rush into these things. I mean, and you don't speculate the way you do. You don't rely on a single line of information or one expert. And you certainly don't make hard claims such as it's not possible to determine what happened. So all that sort of aside, that's what first got reported. But then it wasn't long after that that the internet turned to the 5G boogeyman.
Oh, boy. Right?
Oh, boy.
Oh, yeah, right.
Yep, that's
Boogeyman. Are you sure those birds weren't vaccinated, Evan?
Right, yeah, or had microchips and all of their, the chips took over their bodies. My gosh. Boogeyman, 5Gs. That's 5Gs in the word boogeyman. In my searches today, guess what conspiracy theory for the last several years accompanies every report of flocks of birds crashing to the earth?
5G.
5G, yep. So that's really become more, I think, of a joke than anything. I don't really know who's taking that seriously. It's almost,
how about chemtrails?
Yeah, right. It's just, oh boy. But 5G is the boogeyman. It's the cause of everything wrong out there. So yeah, the video's real. But all right, but what actually happened to the birds? And that's where the more current news reports, you know, a week later come out, in which there have been times for experts and specialists to study the video and get their opinions as to what this was. And now it's pretty much the universal conclusion that this flock was attacked from above by another bird, a raptor. And due to the angle of the attack and the flock's proximity to the ground, the birds instinctually took flight in the opposite direction of the attack, which happened to be the direction of the ground. Boom. Sent them crashing down into the ground. And, you know, again, depending on the size of a flock, you can see how the higher birds would force the lower birds into crashing. They just all start to move in that direction, and unfortunately, the lower birds take the brunt of it.
Yeah, their flocking algorithm failed. It's not perfect, and it didn't work this time.
Mm-hmm.
And it is occasionally birds fly into the ground. This is not unprecedented.
Correct.
And it's just
a lot of them all at once.
Yes. Because as you said, you could have thousands of birds flocking together. You know, they're sort of following. They're not following a leader. There's sort of a behavioral algorithm there in terms of how they just sort of flow around, the murmuration, as you say. And there is nobody directing traffic. They're just all following these algorithms, and sometimes the events conspire to make them fly into the ground. It happens.
It's still sad.
They do, and there's plenty of documented reports over many years of this happening. And all not for the exact same reason, but certainly attacks by raptors on these flocks is one of the primary causes for these kinds of bird strikes, where people wake up in the morning and all of a sudden there's 5,000 birds on the ground. Now cameras, you know, are more ubiquitous now than ever. We're capturing more video footage now than ever. We will start to be able to witness these kinds of events more readily. And that was, you know, in a way, I think almost the remarkable part of this is that the camera was on at the right point, looking in the correct direction to witness this thing exactly happen.
Yeah.
So that in itself was sort of remarkable. But, you know, think about how many ring systems houses have or other, you know, exterior security systems now on houses. It's become, you know, rather common in lots of
places. There's so many cameras. It's like, yeah.
Oh, yeah. You watch any true crime, like almost anything that happens in public, there's cameras on it. You'll be able to like forensically stitch them together and have like a film, like a feature Hollywood film about what happened.
Before I wrap up, I do want to say a couple of things about bird populations in general, just food for thought. Speaking of food, feral cats kill between 1.3 billion and 4 billion birds alone in the United States every year.
That's wow. So sad.
That is a
don't
lot
let your cats
of birds.
Outside. And it's not just feral cats, it's people's pets.
Sure.
Pet cats.
Yeah, it's pet cats that people let wander outside, which is not okay.
No, it's not okay. A 2019 study in Science magazine, found there were 3 billion fewer birds in North America than in the 1970s. That is a 30% decline.
All right, thanks, Evan. Well, everyone, we're going to take a quick break from our show to talk about our sponsor this week, Wondrium.
We often look at the sky as a backdrop to our life here on Earth, when in reality, it's a world of endless fascination. Take a dive into space with Wondrium's new program, The Big Bang and Beyond, exploring the early universe.
Wondrium's the place for everyone who's ever wondered about anything. It's true. You can explore just about any topic you can imagine with video and audio learning experiences. And each course is offered by teachers, professors, and experts. They make learning fun and exciting. The Big Bang and Beyond, exploring the early universe, dives deep into space with facts that are for sure going to blow your mind. Did you know that at 100 billionth of a second after the Big Bang, the universe was at a quadrillion degrees?
Yes.
Or that cosmologists were still debating the validity of the Big Bang model into the 1960s, and we only confirmed the existence of dark matter in the 1970s.
So learn about the universe and so much more with Wondrium. Sign up for a free 22-day trial membership at wondrium.com/skeptics. That's wondrium.com/skeptics to sign up today.
All right, guys, let's get back to the show. Cara, I understand they cured AIDS.
In one woman. Yeah, one woman's nice. AIDS was cured, which is very, very cool. It's not even a published study yet. This is very interesting. So research that was shared at a recent conference, one that's actually going on right now, called the CROI, or the Conference on Retroviruses and Opportunistic Infections, tells the case study of a woman of unspecified age who is actually mixed race, who was cured, and I'm intentionally using that word, cured of acquired immunodeficiency syndrome. She is, from what I understand from the literature, and I think most of the write-ups are saying as well, the third person that has been documented to completely be cured of this disease. Just for a little bit of background, there are about 38 million people living with HIV, human immunodeficiency virus, worldwide, and about 73% of them are in active treatment. There are two kind of interesting and rough reasons that this is so exciting. Did you know that more than half of HIV cases worldwide are in women, but only 11% of clinical trial patients have ever been women?
What? Ooh, that seems off kilter.
Also, when we look at the two examples of individuals who have been previously cured of HIV, they followed a similar pattern. Both of those individuals received bone marrow transplants because they were simultaneously diagnosed with cancers that required that type of transplantation. So they would not have gotten that transplantation just for their HIV/AIDS. They would have only received it because of the cancer. In both of those cases, the individuals got super sick. They both got graft versus host disease, which is dire. One of them almost died. And they got very, very sick, but ultimately they were able to get past it and were deemed cured. Sadly, one of those patients did die a year later from the cancer, but I think the other patient survived for some time. Now, here's the other reason. So I mentioned that this patient is a woman, and there's some kind of not so fun stuff when you look at the history of HIV/AIDS research, that most of the clinical trials were run on men. So, and also it is apparently the case that HIV has a different course in women's bodies, and we still don't fully understand that, but that seems to be sort of the takeaway from a lot of HIV/AIDS researchers. But the other thing is that the vast majority of individuals who are actively waiting for a bone marrow donor are the vast majority of people who get a bone marrow donor successfully are white, and they're Northern European white. And that's because there aren't enough matches in the registry that... Mm-hmm.
As an aside, there was a study I was looking at today. I chose not to be the item I talk about, but it was researchers have figured out a way, or they're in the process of figuring out a way, to make organs for transplantation into a universal donor blood type.
That would be a huge step forward.
The purpose of that is for, you know, to give everybody equal access, you know, to organs, you know, so that, because right now, like if you have a rare blood type, it's really hard to get an organ transplant, because at the first level, you need to match the blood type.
Yeah, at the very first level, and then you start to match different aspects of the tissue,
You go deeper, but that's like, if you don't match the blood type, forget about it, you know. But this could take care of that problem.
Yeah. So I found a study that was highlighted in HemOnc Today a couple of years ago, titled Tremendous Racial and Ethnic Disparity Observed in Access to Matched Donor Stem Cells. And they were specifically looking at the stem cells for bone marrow transplant. And the director of this program at Memorial Sloan Kettering said, quote, "We've identified tremendous racial and ethnic disparity in transplant access. What's more, it's been thought by some that if you just increase the number of registered adult donors, that it would resolve this problem, but it hasn't. This study provides a clear demonstration of how important it is to fund initiatives that will improve outcomes of alternative donor transplantation," kind of like what you were already talking about, "including the use of unrelated donor cord blood." So that's very prescient, because this specific case that we're talking about today, the woman who was cured of HIV/AIDS, she did not get a bone marrow transplantation. She got cord blood. And there seemed to be some real benefits to a cord blood treatment as opposed to a bone marrow transplant. And so first, what's interesting is that the researchers who saw these miraculous kind of recoveries in the two patients who happened to be getting bone marrow transplants for their leukemia, they both had host versus graft disease, right? Or graft versus host disease. And interestingly, researchers thought maybe there's something going on during that disease process that's necessary for the utter obliteration of this retrovirus, like the utter obliteration of HIV/AIDS. But this case, the woman did not get graft versus host disease. She actually was able to leave the hospital 17 days after her cord blood transplant, and she was well. And that's so great. Yeah, it's not just great, but it's like a whew moment for researchers, because they're like, okay, good. We now know that they don't have to go through that horrible process in order for this to work. So the other thing that's interesting is that because it was cord blood, they think that she was able to better A, take the transplant, and B, it allowed for her to do something cool. Cord blood takes a while, I guess, to repopulate. It's a slower process when you get transplanted with embryonic cord blood. So A, the cells within it are less differentiated, right? Because it's going to be much more infused. Obviously, bone marrow is also infused with stem cells, but embryonic cord blood is infused with very young stem cells. It takes a while for them to sort of anchor and populate. And during the time that she was waiting for the transfusion or the transplant to take, she also got a transfusion or a transplant from a matched relative. She was able to get these half-matched, what they call haplocells, from her relative, and they think that's what made the transplant a lot less dangerous, because it sort of protected her immune system while it was going through the process of having these grafted cells take over, right? Because these bone marrow transplants that cancer patients get knock them out.
They're very high risk.
They're super high risk. You basically have no immune system for a while until the new immune system takes over. And so having this intermittent step where there was an engraft from a half-matched relative, that seemed to be helpful. And so this kind of opens up not just future directions for HIV/AIDS treatment, but also potentially for cancer treatment as well, especially in African American or mixed race individuals who don't have access to bone marrow matches. So even though this is very likely not a sustainable or tenable solution to HIV/AIDS worldwide, for those who are sadly unlucky enough to both have HIV/AIDS and leukemia and require this type of treatment, this really does show if one already is in that position, there's a chance to be able to transplant cord blood that already has a mutation that prevents HIV/AIDS from entering the cell. And if you're able to transfuse that cord blood, you can potentially cure AIDS in those patients, which is very cool.
That's amazing.
It is.
It's amazing, right?
Yeah. And that's, you know, this the bone marrow transplant is the first stem cell, you know, clinical application in existence. Yeah. It goes back decades, and it's really still the only one. The
absolutely,
one.
But to be able to transplant cord blood from these umbilical cells, they just simply have more properties, very likely because they're so young and so undifferentiated. And they're not carrying, you know, even though we have stem cells in our bone marrow, we're still carrying all of the sort of hallmarks of age. The donors who are giving this stem cell material, it's still coming out very often of an older donor, right? Mm-hmm. And if we're taking embryonic stem cells that have not differentiated, that have not, you know, undergone any sort of disease processes, they've not carried all these mutations and carcinogens and all the things that we are exposed to throughout life, there's just something really kind of magic about this cord blood that could open things up in the future.
Yeah, very cool. All right, Jay, it's Who's That Noisy time.
All right, guys, last week I played this noisy.
Jay, is that Andre the Giant?
No. Oh,
no. Very deep voice, whatever that creature.
Hello, lady.
Hello, lady. So lots of people wrote this in, but one person, the first person that wrote it, said, that, sir, is a tauntaun. That is not a tauntaun.
No, that's not a tauntaun.
No, it does kind of sound like a tauntaun. another listener named Adam Hepburn. Adam has written in many times. He said, my man, Jaysef. He says, you know, this is one of the listeners who likes to ask his daughters. Bottom line is, he says, is it a camel? And I did say that it was an animal. No, it is not a camel. But man, camels make noises like this too. So that's not a bad guess. Next listener wrote in Cameron Wood, and he just said the word cow.
It does sound bovine in nature.
Yes, it is not a cow.
Yeah, but, you know, most of people have heard cows, and that's not what they sound like. If you had no idea what a cow sounded like, I guess that would be a good guess. Well, but you could think of
different kinds of cows, aren't there?
Yeah, but you could think of something like maybe like a buffalo, a bison,
elk.
A yak. I don't think it's any of those.
An ibex. What are they called?
Ibex.
Those? Ibex.
Ibex.
Ibex. Ibex. Yeah, I said ibex. Also, that's not cow-like.
Well, it just, what if that turns out to be the right answer, though?
All right, another listener, guys. Named Asha wrote in and said, Yowdy howdy Jay, I'm guessing this is the sound of a reindeer. And he said, this is based purely on the spelling of the name of the person who sent in the noisy, as I don't know what reindeer sound like because I don't live at the North Pole. But it is not a reindeer. These are all perfectly cromulent guesses. Another listener wrote in named Shane Hillier, and Shane said this week's guest is a hyena.
That is not a hyena.
That is not a hyena.
It's not a hyena.
No, I saw The Lion King. That is not a hyena.
We have a winner. I'm very excited because we haven't had one in a little while. Listener named Clark wrote in, and he said in the subject line, didn't even get to the email, in the subject line he wrote, betcha that's a tiger.
Whoa.
And indeed, that is a tiger. Listen again.
So obviously a tiger.
Very, I know. Well, that's Bob. That's why Who's That Noisy is interesting, because you just never know. The tiger
only when it was chuffing. That's the only time it sounded like a tiger. The rest of that sounds weird.
Yeah, I know. But, you know, he was kind of talking to them in a way, you know, like just reacting to them being there and wanting to be pet and all that stuff. Because, you know, the tiger was definitely, like, able to be around people. Because, you know, it just seemed like, you know, this was somebody's pet, to be honest with you. Could you imagine?
Which, by the way.
Yeah.
No. Don't
do that.
No pet tigers.
But could you just imagine, though, having, you know, exposure to a cat of that size that was friendly and to you in any capacity?
But none of them are friendly. That's the thing.
Yeah. I'm not, look, like, everybody knows how dangerous it is, Kara, but there are people who live with these animals.
I know. And those people are bad.
Yeah. But I'm just marveling at how amazing it would be to interact with a cat of that size, as long as your life wasn't, you know, imminently in danger.
Yes, it's nice to imagine it, but it won't
happen. Yes, it's nice to imagine a fantasy world in which your life would not be intimately in danger, but it would be.
Kara, I want to be a cat. Okay, no, I'm just kidding.
I know.
No,
but this is sadly, this is why these people exploit this, because so many people want to be close to these animals.
Oh, yeah.
And so people pay to go and stand next to them and take pictures and pet it. And is very sad for the animal.
Yeah, I know. I really wanted. Yeah. I just love. I love lions, and I, you know, but I know, you know, I know the whole thing. It's just not cool. Yeah. But they're, you know, you gotta really just, you know, appreciate them from afar.
There are zoos where you can get quite close, where they are still kept very safe and they're cared for, and they, you know, these are animals that were bred for these programs where they do very good intervention and research. So you can get close to them. Just, you know, don't go see the Tiger King.
I agree.
You can watch the Tiger King, but don't replicate what they do. The thing that exactly. is like the dirty little secret of it, it's like they pay so that people can, you know, snuggle with tiger cubs. There's way more tiger cubs than adult tigers.
Mm-hmm.
And what's happening to all those? Those exactly. tiger cubs. They're basically churning out cubs to feed an industry, you know, of tiger cubs, and then they just destroy them.
Animals,
get too big,
right?
Yeah.
Well, and the really, boring. I mean, the outcome of that is you guys know that there's significantly more tigers in captivity than in the wild, right?
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah.
There are only 3,900 tigers remaining in the wild.
Crazy.
And there are more than 5,000 just in the U.S. in captivity.
Just in the U.S., yeah.
Yeah.
All right, guys, I have a new noisy. Let's get over to something a little bit more happy.
Yeah.
An ibex.
This is a noisy sent in by a listener named Manu, and here it is.
And heu kende hire frum kende dansunu, and hine mid chilt cladum bewand, and hine unbinna.
What is that? What are we hearing right there?
That's a cat.
It's some form of elvish.
So, guys, as you know, we have four shows coming up. We have two shows in New York City and two shows in Boston.
New York City.
That's right. They all start on March 25th, and they're over that weekend. You can go to theskepticsguide.org/events to see everything. And, you know, guys, we are, you know, we're having these events. We know that COVID, we just had a spike, but things are starting to get, you know, very safe now. Numbers are dropping dramatically. You also do need to be vaccinated to even come to these events, so it's going to be very safe.
And this is the venues are demanding this. Like in New York, you have to bring like proof of vaccination.
Right? Yeah, I put all that information. You know, when you buy your tickets, you could read about that. But just basically, you need to be able to prove that you were vaccinated. And in New York, you definitely need to bring your ID as well. But most importantly, we're going to be in New York, we're going to be in Boston, and it's very likely that we won't be doing these cities for another 2 or 3 years. You know, just depends on how the wind blows, but we're not going to be there. We don't do this that often. So please do, if you're interested, please do come to those shows, because it could be quite a while before we're in this area again. Mm-hmm. Go to theskepticsguide.org/events.
Cool. All right. Quick email. Every single person living in Australia emailed us
to point out
when we were talking about gird your loins that
what is that, a city
the word
in the middle of Australia?
Makes an appearance in their national anthem. Here are the lyrics.
Whoa.
It begins, Australia's sons, let us rejoice, for we are young and free. We've golden soil and wealth for toil. Our home is girt by sea.
I guess the past tense of gird.
Yeah.
Gert.
Is that the past tense?
Meaning surrounded so. By. I don't know. I don't know if that's the past
or maybe
tense.
Maybe it's
or what
the Australian tense of gird.
Just a form of gird. Gert by sea. Maybe it's the poetic use of the word. So that's cool.
Yeah.
So they all and knew it. They all knew what gird meant.
Yeah, they're making fun of us the whole time.
Yeah.
Wow.
All right, but we also do have a name that logical fallacy. This comes from Paul, and the email's a little meandering, so I'm going to pull what I think the question is out of it, but I'm just going to read the whole thing first. Paul writes, been a listener for years and finally decided to stop freeloading and become a patron. Thank you, Paul. You guys have taught me so much and are the number one reason I have become such a critical thinker, and for you, I thank you. I was having a conversation with my dad today, and he was telling me about a conversation he had recently regarding vaccine mandates. This other guy's opinion was that vaccines should not be mandatory. My dad asked, well, what about restaurants? To which he responded, if you don't like it, don't go to a restaurant then. My dad told me that just makes no logical sense. Then he retracted that statement saying that, well, No, wrong choice of word. It isn't logic. It's more of just a statement or something to that effect. This then launched us into a conversation about logical fallacies, and I argued that this guy's response was a logical fallacy, but I couldn't articulate why, let alone what the logical fallacy was. So my first question is, what is the logical fallacy, if it falls under the category of being one? And secondly, what would you have said to my dad had you been in the discussion in response to the logic is the wrong choice of word statement? Although the answer is kind of the same once you say that, yeah, it's a logical fallacy. But so let me just answer the question of like, what is a logical fallacy? Actually, when we talk about logical fallacies in terms of arguments and defending a position, we're mostly talking about informal logical fallacies. And because they're informal, there is no real strict definition. It's just really when an argument fails because of its structure. And without necessarily committing a formal logical fallacy, you know, where the statement has to be wrong. And informal logical fallacies are very context dependent. They don't have to be wrong. It's just how you're using it.
Although we often call a non sequitur an informal fallacy, even though that is technically a formal fallacy.
Yeah, that is a formal fallacy.
Yeah.
But a non sequitur is also vague. It just means that it doesn't follow.
Yeah, it doesn't. Yeah. But that's the whole point of a formal logical fallacy, right? It's like proposition one, proposition two, conclusion. And if there's something wrong with the propositional logic there, the conclusion doesn't follow. So you end up with a false conclusion. So there's very strict rules about pointing out formal or
the formal logical fallacies are very specific.
Yeah. Like
if you're saying that A equals B and B equals C, A must equal C, right? That's
exactly.
That's formal logic. And if you're saying that A doesn't equal C, that's a formal logical fallacy. Mm. That's just saying it must be wrong by its very structure. All right, but let me pull out, I think, what's going on here. So he wants to know, what is this a logical fallacy? And if so, what is it? Saying that, you know, vaccines should be mandatory. And then another person saying, well, I don't think vaccines should be mandatory. To which, you know, the first person says, well, what about restaurants? Second person says, well, if you don't like it, don't go to a restaurant then. So what they're saying is that, you know, if you don't like the fact that there may be people at the restaurant who are not vaccinated, then the onus is on you not to go to the restaurant. That's not a justification for vaccine mandates. So I think there's an informal logical fallacy in there.
So the guy who's saying don't go to the restaurant is the one committing the informal logical fallacy? Okay,
yeah.
Got it.
He's basically saying we don't need mandates, and the fact that people can't go to restaurants is not a reason, because you can just if you don't want to go, then don't go. If you don't want to expose yourself, then you just choose not to go to the restaurant.
Yeah, but then how are you supposed to participate in society if there are no mandates?
So you're kind of nibbling around the edge of what I think is the core problem here. Mm. So I think this is a very subtle logical fallacy.
Okay.
And it's one that is listed, you know, typically when you look at lists in my list, you know, of the common logical fallacies. It's been in most of the lists that I've seen, you know, circulating within skeptical circles. But it's one we don't hear a lot about because it's hard to detect because it's something that's absent. Let me say that. Mm-hmm. It's always hard to know what's not there. So what's a fallacy based on what is not present, not being
absence
stated?
Oh, unstated major premise.
Unstated major premise.
I feel like we're playing one of those
there's an unstated major premise here. There's probably multiple unstated. So, you know, this is again why it's so good to have at least some basic education in logic and philosophy, because, you know, if you don't understand what this is, like what a premise is and a logical connection and an argument, then you have no hope of sort of navigating the complexities of statements like this. So when the person says, if you don't, you know, want to expose yourself to the vaccine, then the solution is you don't go to the restaurant. So what's the unstated major premise here? I think it's what the purpose of the mandates are. He's the unstated major premise is that the purpose is to protect you from people who are not vaccinated. Mm. But that's not the only purpose.
No, it's to protect others.
It's to protect everyone, but also the purpose of a mandate is, for example, as you said, Kara, it's to allow businesses to function.
Yeah, so it's to protect the waiter at the restaurant.
And the restaurant itself. Yeah. If you say, well, don't go to a restaurant, it's like, yeah, but what about all the restaurants now that can't function because people aren't going there because it's unsafe because there's no vaccine mandate? That's not the purpose of a mandate. The purpose of the mandate, you know, and often explicitly, meaning that when it's being defended, it's like, because we, in order for businesses to operate, there needs to be a certain amount of uniformity during the middle, during the peak, you know, we want, there has to be a certain level of safety. Now, again, you may still disagree with the mandate. I'm not saying that, you know, I understand this is a complicated political question, but the point is, then you have to address the actual reason for the mandate. And if you're not addressing it, you're just answering something else. So first of all, it could be a straw man. You know, if you explicitly state this is the reason for the mandate, but if you just don't state it, then it's an unstated major premise. That, again, I think this is one of those, the most often missed problems with arguments, because it's, again, it's hard to detect what isn't there unless you specifically think about it. So it's always good to back up and say, and deconstruct an argument to say, what are all the premises? And does this cover all of the necessary premises for the argument? What's the logical connection, and what is the conclusion that we can therefore draw from it? When you break it down like that, it becomes a lot more obvious and a lot easier. And sometimes when people are disagreeing and they just can't seem to get on the same page, part of the reason for the failure to understand each other's arguments is that they're starting with different premises, but they never explicitly state their premises. So it's not even clear to each other that they're proceeding from different premises. So it's hopeless until you resolve that difference, which is the beginning of the argument, the premises. Until you resolve that difference, you have no hope of resolving the conclusions, right?
And you're just going to be running around each other.
Yeah. Like, that's when you get super frustrated. Yeah. Like, oh my God.
Yeah. I found a great example, Steve, online by, I guess, I don't know if he's a philosopher, but somebody named Tim Harding, who wrote a short article on the fallacy of the unstated major premise, by the way, also known as begging the question.
Yes.
That's what that means.
Yeah.
And so he was saying an invalid version, a place where there is an unstated major premise would be somebody trying to argue murder is morally wrong, therefore abortion is morally wrong.
Yeah.
But they're unstating their major premise. Right. But if they instead argued abortion is murder, murder is morally wrong, therefore abortion is morally wrong, they are now making a logical argument. It doesn't necessarily mean they are correct, but at least there is internal logic.
The structure is valid.
Yes, exactly.
Right. So that's the difference between a valid argument and a sound argument.
Mm-hmm.
A valid argument means that it structurally works, right? And the logical connection works. A sound argument means that that's true, but all the premises also have to be correct and sufficient, right?
Right.
The whole argument works from premise to logic to conclusion, whereas valid just means the logic works. But you could still be starting with bad premises and get to a wrong conclusion.
But when they're stated, at least you know what you're arguing about.
Exactly. Yeah. Exactly. That's a great example. Yeah.
Yeah.
And if you don't realize you're doing it, it's like, but my logic is unassailable. You're right. The problem's not with your logic. That's why it's unassailable. It's the problem is with your premises, or you're not examining your premises. You're not even aware of what all the premises are. You're just assuming one premise. And this is like, when I get into political arguments, this is what's happening. This is the rule, not the exception. This is what everyone does all the time, just to exaggerate a little bit. But just this is sort of the standard operating procedure, is everyone starting from their own premises and selecting the logic that they're using.
And then never
examining them, and then declaring the other side either immoral or stupid or whatever.
Ad hominem attack, and then that's it.
Yeah. And it speaks exactly to – I just did a talk on science communication. I just recorded it yesterday, actually. And, you know, I do a standard top five of science communication. And the very first one is always know your audience. And a big part of it is to try at least to understand their unstated major premises.
Yeah.
You know, what are they coming to the room already thinking is true? And then what are you coming to the room saying is true? And where are we missing each other?
Yeah. So to give you another example, because we talked recently about the whole Joe Rogan hubbub. I wrote about it on my blog, and there's been
many emails about that.
But, you know, the comments are running into the hundreds on that. And It's there's two sides, basically, and talking completely past each other because they are proceeding from different premises. I mean, now, of course, I think the side that I'm on, I'm explicitly stating my premises. I'm saying, you know, this is the scenario that I'm talking about. So essentially, it's the difference between free speech and editorial control, right?
Right.
And they keep saying, if you tell somebody, if you take away their platform, that's censorship. It's like, but you're assuming that they had a right to that platform in the first place.
Right.
This isn't the corner square,
that, like the town that, square.
Yeah, there's somebody, they bring up the town square, and my analogy, okay, if you want to go with the town square analogy, but this person's not standing in the middle of the town square. Somebody gave them access to a private balcony overlooking the town square yeah. where their voice carries above everyone else's, and they don't have a right to that balcony. They don't own the balcony.
Nice.
Somebody else gave them access to it, and they could take it away because it's right. a private balcony. And they could decide to have criteria to admit people to that balcony.
What do they say to that?
Nothing. That's the thing. They never respond to my actual points.
Yeah,
they just go off on irrelevant tangents, or they restate their premise, which is that it's censorship. It's like, yeah, but I just showed you why it isn't.
I hate humans.
Right.
Or they say First Amendment. This is not even a First Amendment issue.
Nope.
Because the government, we're not talking about the government, we're talking about private companies.
Right.
So again, they just never challenge their premises. They just get to their conclusion as quickly as they can, but they're often backfilling from the conclusion.
They got their narrative and nothing else matters.
Right.
Well, yeah, we're seeing also just a lot of weird sacred cow stuff
about
this specific cult of personality. Like, no, you're the ones who aren't being skeptical enough. He's skeptical because he brings on the people who are out of the mainstream, and they're blowing holes in the major narrative. And it's like, oh God, not the definition of skepticism.
That's contrarian.
Yeah, exactly.
The other thing that's interesting is that in that article, I didn't even propose a solution. Like, I didn't advocate for anything.
You didn't talk about censorship.
I didn't. All I said was, this Joe Rogan described his own editorial process, and I quoted him. He basically said, I have on interesting people, and I talk to interesting people. And, he also said, I'm not an expert, and I don't really, prepare to the point where I can hold them accountable for what they're saying. They're the experts. I just have interesting conversations with them, right? That's his editorial process, that by his own description. And I made a few points, but basically they were related to the fact that when you follow that algorithm, that turns you into a fire hose of misinformation.
Right.
That leads to you spreading misinformation.
There's no firewall. There's no quality.
Interesting.
Control.
Yeah. If interesting is your only criterion, interesting usually means wrong.
Well, that's how you become Facebook.
Art Bell was interesting.
It's National Enquirer. That's what National Enquirer is.
Yeah,
well, that's
it is.
Also
it's
what
coast
all
to
of
coast
our social media channels
Bell,
are.
Yeah.
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 So I was just pointing that fact out. I didn't say anything that should happen at all. And the people who think that I don't think they really are, but who like to think that they're defending free speech assumed all kinds of things. Because then there's only two sides. Either you're 100% down with free speech and you everything that even hints at limiting it is an abomination, or you're completely against, you're a fascist against free speech. That's it. And they explicitly state that, like, that completely binary thinking. Yeah. And explicitly, they're not even, you don't have to even infer it from what they're saying.
No subtlety whatsoever. None. No.
Yeah. It's just, again, they're not examining their logic. They're not breaking down their arguments. They're not saying, all right, let's figure out what our premises are and then go from there. They're not examining their own premises. It's just, you said something bad about Joe Rogan. You're a Nazi. That was literally their logic.
Right from the A to B.
I also saw some real hate coming from individuals who I made the statement because I quoted the first letter that was written to Spotify that a specific portion of the listenership is vulnerable. Mm-hmm. And I made that statement because that portion of the listenership is representative by demographic descriptors. There's a lot of crossover with that demographic and the demographic of individuals who have refused to get vaccinated.
Mm-hmm.
But I got a lot of hate on social media from that, and also in emails from people who are like, you're calling me vulnerable. You're calling me stupid. I am not stupid. I'm making an active choice not to get vaccinated. And that's a really hard thing. It's a hard conversation to have with somebody to say, you've been duped.
Of course.
Like, that is very painful.
Yeah, pride kicks
for
in.
For people to hear. Yeah. Of course.
It's not only painful, but, you know, 99% of the people that hear it are going to reject it no matter what you say.
That's absolutely one of the core dilemmas of skeptical activism is we deal with people who have been victimized by con artists or by conspiracy theories or by cults or whatever. And how do you point that out to them without them feeling bad about themselves? You know, for because they're obviously going to reject this notion that they've been duped. Nobody wants to feel that way. Con artists bank on that. That's like one
of their stock and trade.
They count on the fact that the victims are going to be too embarrassed to go to the police or to call them out on it, you know? So it's a very tricky thing to deal with. Very tricky thing to deal with.
Right, because then you have the backfire problem. Like, you've got to be careful that they don't just double down and dig in heels and
Which often happens. All right, guys, let's go on with science fiction.
It's time for science or fiction.
Each week, I come up with 3 science news items or facts, 2 real and 1 fake, and then I challenge my panel of skeptics to tell me which one is the fake. Just 3 news items this week. No theme. Ready?
Let's go.
Everybody ready? Let's go. Item number 1, surgeons successfully implanted the first wireless electrodes that bypass the retina and optic nerve and directly stimulate the visual cortex with information received from an external camera. Item number 2, scientists have used data from radio telescopes to finally shed light on an enduring mystery, what initiates a lightning strike, supporting the theory that it begins with propagating streamers of cold plasma. And item number 3, scientists have observed untrained orangutans in captivity that, when provided with a hammer and rock core, spontaneously used the hammer to create sharp rocks that they then used as a cutting tool. Evan, go first.
It's always the worst feeling.
It is a terrible feeling. All right. Well, I did not read any of these, so I'll start with that. Number 1, surgeons successfully implanted the first wireless electrodes bypassing the retina and optic nerve, directly stimulating the visual cortex with information received from an external camera.
Yeah, so basically when I say bypass the retina and optic nerve, because they're going from the image and then communicating that directly to the visual cortex, they're not sending the information through the retina or through the optic nerve at all.
It sounds very cool, and it also sounds plausible. I'm trying to think of, you know, beyond it being, what's the inherent problem here? I'm not seeing it, so I'm tending to think that one's science. The next one about scientists have used data from radio telescopes to finally shed light on an enduring mystery, what initiates a lightning strike? That's an enduring mystery, huh? Supporting the theory. Supporting the theory that it begins with propagating streamers of cold plasma. I don't know. I didn't know that. I didn't know that that was the theory of what initiates the lightning strike. Cold plasma, huh? Don't know. Let's see. And then the last one, scientists have observed untrained orangutans in captivity. When you provide them with a hammer and a rock core, they spontaneously use the hammer to create sharp rocks that they then used as a cutting tool.
So I'll add, since you're going first, I didn't want to cram everything into a sentence. They had food that they could only get to by cutting through like string. So they were highly motivated, you know, to solve that problem, just for the context.
Gotcha.
They didn't just start cutting themselves or something. They were trying to get to food.
Untrained orangutans in captivity. Oh gosh, I don't know about this one. It's either the radio telescopes or the orangutans. I'll say the orangutans. I don't know that they put all those steps together being untrained. Just a guess.
Okay, Bob.
Let's see. I totally want to believe number 1, directly stimulating the visual cortex. So I'm going to say that one is science. I wonder, going directly in raw. I mean, I know that the retina, to a certain extent, does some low-level processing of the image first. I wonder what that means in terms of this type of research that you're talking about here. But I'm going to say that's science. The radio telescopes and the plasma, I don't know, man. Just got nothing to say on that one. I'll say that's science. The orangutan one, I'm not buying. I mean, orangutans using
a hammer and rock, you're getting sharp rocks and using it as a tool? I don't think so. I'm not buying that at all.
Okay, Jay.
That's funny because I'm thinking that the third one about the orangutans is true. I believe that because they are very, very intelligent. Now I'll go to the second one here. This is the one about the radio telescopes. I mean, this is, you know, I wouldn't be surprised that plasma has something to do with lightning. I just don't understand why it's cold plasma. And I'm not even really clear about, you know, hot and cold plasma when it comes to lightning.
Does anybody who went already object if I tell Jay what cold plasma is?
Nah, go ahead.
I don't object.
I don't know what it is.
Low density?
Thank you.
No, so plasma is the most common form of regular matter in the universe, right? That's what happens when a gas gets so hot that it strips the electrons off the proton, so it's charged gas, right? Yeah. It's an ionized gas. So cold plasma is when that happens when it's colder. And it's not that they're being stripped away by heat. Something else is happening that's separating the electrons from the protons to at least some degree that you have a plasma, but it's not that hot. So it's a cold plasma.
All right.
So it's like ionized gas without heat. Okay.
All right. For some reason, what you said makes me think that's even more true. So I'm going to say that the first one about the optic nerve is the fake because I don't think we're there yet.
Okay. And Kara.
I mean, I want the – okay, so the first wireless electrodes, pretty cool, bypass retina and optic nerve. So basically, these electrodes are being implanted directly into the visual cortex, into the occipital lobe, and information from a camera is being fed to that, and then the brain is processing that information at that level. It's kind of, and I mean, I think you kind of hear about this because you know about cortical blindness. This is an actual thing where people have – damage to their, it's like the opposite effect, right? They have damage to their visual cortex, but all the other structures are intact. And even though they don't think they can see, they'll do things like catch balls and walk off steps and things like that. And so this is sort of like turning that on its ear. We're going to just send the information directly to the, and I don't know why that wouldn't work. I think it's probably not quite like vision. It's probably something akin to vision, but it doesn't say here that they can see as well as somebody who has fully intact retina and optic nerve. So I don't know. I want this one to be science. So I'm going to say that's science. I think that I don't understand the lightning one at all. I didn't know we don't know what starts lightning. I figured that was something we already understood.
Yeah.
And the weird thing is, right. The orangutan one was, I was like, oh yeah, sure, whatever, that I buy that. And then of course the two guys started talking about and really breaking it down. And I'm starting to be skeptical about this one as well. Mostly because I feel like if orangutans spontaneously could use hammer-like objects, and yes, I know those are human made, but there are things in nature that are hammer-like. So if an orangutan could spontaneously take a rock core and a hammer-like object and make sharp tools and then cut things open, I think they would have done it already more often.
Yeah.
And we would have seen this behavior in nature. I could definitely see them learning how to do something like that. And I bet you that's the twist here. I bet you they were taught how to do it. But I don't know, because he said untrained. So I think I'm going to go with that one being the fiction also.
All right. So you guys all agree on the second one, mainly because you didn't understand it, but we'll start there. Scientists have used data from radio telescopes to finally shed light on an enduring mystery, what initiates a lightning strike, supporting the theory that it begins with propagating streamers of cold plasma. You guys all think this one is science, and this one is science. This is science. So no sweep for me. And the thing that I found most interesting is that we didn't know what initiates lightning.
Yeah, right.
We still don't really know, but this like is a strong support for this theory. Did anybody know what the alternate hypothesis is for how lightning strikes start?
Thor and stuff, you know.
Yeah, Zeus.
I think we've mentioned, when I read it, I'm like, yeah, that's not, I think we mentioned this on the show at some point in the last 17 years. Cosmic rays hitting the atmosphere.
Yeah.
You know, oh, yeah. I remember that.
Triggering. Yeah, right? That's a vague memory there. So that's the other theory, is that it's the cosmic rays. So versus just like something happening spontaneously within the cloud itself. So this data, which is like basically using multiple different radio telescopes examining multiple, you know, lightning strikes, especially that critical phase right before the lightning initiates, trying to figure out what's happening there, supports the intrinsic theory, this notion that the lightning is being initiated in the cloud itself, is not being like has to be hit by cosmic rays or anything. And you know, what they found was this: before the lightning bolt itself goes off, you have this propagating and multiplying like streamers. So these streamers are like little lightning bolts of cold plasma, right? And they keep branching and branching and branching, so you get more and more and more and more of them, although they're moving at a constant speed, which they found was odd, but that's what the data is showing. And then it gets to a critical point where then the lightning bolt initiates. So Jay, remember the Who's That Noisy from a few weeks ago?
Absolutely, yeah. The
sound before a lightning
bolt,
because I wonder if that's the streamers of cold plasma. I don't know.
Yeah.
I couldn't find if that there's an actual connection there, but that's made me think of that. Yeah, so that's interesting. Probably not the final word on this controversy, but the data does support that. Okay, let's go back to number one. Surgeons successfully implanted the first wireless electrodes that bypass the retina and optic nerve and directly stimulate the visual cortex with information received from an external camera. Jay, you think this one is the fiction. Everyone else thinks this one is science. And this one is science.
Yeah.
Jay.
How's it work?
Yeah. So, cool. Well, I didn't That's say really that it cool. works. I just said that they implanted the electrode.
Oh, no.
Oh, that's rude.
If you read very carefully, you'll notice that I never say anything about it working.
No, they just implanted. That's all they...
But yeah, this is basically it's at the proof of concept stage. And they did successfully implant the electrodes. That's the news items, that they implanted the electrodes. So the electrodes are wireless, so that is good for a couple of reasons. One, so there's no wires crossing the skull, right? So there's no source of infection that could get through, into the brain.
Oh yeah, that is pretty cool.
They are powered by the wireless signals too, so they don't need to have their own power. They don't need batteries that could run out or whatever. So the wireless signal both can get the images directly to the visual cortex and can also power those electrodes.
How deep can that go, though? I mean,
these are surface electrodes,
right? I mean,
also, like, would you have interference if you were like walking by other wireless signals?
That's a really good question.
Yeah. Yikes.
So the electrodes themselves are called wireless floating microelectrode arrays, or WFMAs. They receive their power and their digital commands over wireless link. And sent to from an external camera, which has the signal. Now, they make it very clear that this is not going to provide normal vision, right? It's not like the person's going to be seeing what the camera is imaging. Part of that, I think one of you alluded to the fact that a lot of the processing occurs even before the signal gets to the brain.
Right.
There's processing that occurs in the nerves and in the brainstem, the more primitive pathway. It's not just getting raw signal to the visual cortex. Now, of course, you could argue that we could maybe duplicate that processing.
Sure.
So it's also not delivering raw signal to the cortex. Part of the problem is going to be mapping it to the visual cortex, where we have to make sure that the visual cortex is getting a signal it recognizes, right, knows what to do with.
Right, but the right neurons are seeing the right
exactly.
things.
Yeah, exactly. There's what we call somatotopic mapping that happens. But in any case, the goal of this setup is not to provide normal vision. It's to give visual feedback that people can use to visually interact with their environment, even though what they're seeing may not be what we see, what normal vision.
Yeah,
sees.
Yeah. Did you ever see the brain port? It's like a thing they put on people's tongues.
What?
Huh?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, it's really cool. It's like a multi-electrode array that goes on your tongue, and you wear these glasses, and the glasses take a video, and it sends that information very crudely to a sort of low res, almost like a 64 channel or like a low bit image on the tongue. And for people who are totally blind, they with time are able to start translating that pattern of electricity on their tongue to a visual image. It doesn't look like vision though. I interviewed a woman who used it to make art, and she learned how to weld with it. It was really cool. And she said it felt like she was sewing with light. Like that was her experience.
Wow.
But it didn't look like vision. It was kind of like vision.
Yeah, right. It's
very cool.
It's not like normal vision, but it can benefit the user for performing visually guided tasks.
Right. Like you can see edge detection and really important things like that.
Right. And why would you bypass the retina and the optic nerve.
Well, what if you don't have one?
What if you don't have one?
Right, that would be
so. For people who may not even have a functioning retina or nerve to use, this is the only option. But this is, you know, once you get this to work so that people can actually use it functionally, then, you know, in a way, there's mostly incremental improvements between this and Geordi LaForge, right, with the visor, where. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Right. I mean, just eventually we will get more and more detailed and processed and whatever, you know, mapped out information to the visual cortex. And people could, you know, maybe theoretically see with a device like this.
And also do it early. Do it when they're young.
Yes,
our brains are so plastic. It's so cool. Like, they'll learn how to work with this.
And eventually it'll be even better than natural sight.
Even better.
Bob, I love your freaking enthusiasm, man.
Yep, amazing shit's coming, and I'm going to be dead, and I'm going to miss it.
But you won't know because you'll be dead. I know. Don't worry about it.
Yes.
No, all right, I feel number better. Three. Scientists have observed untrained orangutans in captivity. That one provided with a hammer and a rock core. Spontaneously used the hammer to create sharp rocks, and they then used as a cutting tool. So this is the fiction. But so you guys were correct that something did happen, just not this. This was just beyond what the orangutans did. So they did have untrained orangutans in captivity, and they provided them with a hammer and a rock core. And what did they do?
They put it in their butt.
They used the hammer. They ignored the rock and used the hammer for other things.
And they smashed the rocks with the hammers.
So they took the hammer and they began to smash stuff with it. Right. Uh-huh. So they not the rock and not the food, whatever, but they did sort of bang on parts of their environment, you know, with the hammer. So the scientists, you know, being very positive in their interpretation, being very optimistic, said the orangutans, they knew how to use the hammer, even though they didn't use it in any directed way. They knew that it was a percussive tool. Right.
Okay. So there's that. Yeah, they picked it up and hit things with it.
Yeah, exactly. They picked it up and hit things with it. I think keep in mind the purpose of this study, of this observation, was to try to look at the most basic roots of primate tool use, of human tool use. Mm-hmm. So we're going back to, like, what might the common ancestor of orangutans and humans, what might they have been able to do? And so how much distance is there between that and human tool use? So they were able to pick up a tool that they did not create, but that they knew that this was something that you hit stuff with. Okay, that's not a big leap, but still they did it. But they did not fashion rocks. But they did smash rocks together, right? And some of those rocks that they smashed together did give off sharp flakes. They didn't do anything with that. But that happened. The other thing
that
they
abandoned the hammer and then hit rocks together?
Yes.
I think they probably just did all of that, all of those things.
Then when they were given a sharpened rock, so they didn't make the sharpened rock, but they were given a sharpened rock, they used the sharpened rock to cut open the food.
That's cool.
They were untrained and unenculturated. I never heard that word before.
Yeah, unenculturated. I like it.
When provided with a human-made sharp stone, one orangutan spontaneously used it as a cutting tool. Okay, so without being shown. So So of the five orangutans that they were studying, they were given these sharp stones. One of them spontaneously used it as a cutting tool. So there, you can see that's the most primitive, like, elements of stone tool use are there. They didn't spontaneously make a sharp stone tool. They did not even modify it. But they did use it when it was provided. So if there were stones that were accidentally created, because all you're talking about is like flaking a flint stone off of a core, you know, that could happen without deliberately doing it. You know what I mean? Mm-hmm. And of course, I'm sure you guys have probably played with rocks that had a sharp edge to them.
Of course.
They happen spontaneously, you know, just you don't have to necessarily make it. So that could certainly have been the seeds.
Yeah.
You know, of doing that, like they pick up their, you know, they orangutans can use sharp rocks to do stuff, right? They can use the tool if it's there in their environment. So it's not, and they can bang stuff together, right?
Right.
So there's the whole idea was, so it's not that far.
No, they just have to make the connection between banging stuff together and
how
then
to
using
make
it.
The sharp tool.
I can make a sharp tool, yeah, and then I can use it. I can have it on demand.
You just make them a little smarter, give them a million years, and they'll do it.
Yeah, totally.
That's and the funny thing is, about. I'm sure, I mean, I shouldn't say I'm sure, but there have probably been a million studies where you just showed them how and then they did.
Totally.
Right?
Yeah. Okay. That's why they had to say untrained and unenculturated.
Untrained
is
the key.
Yeah. Because
they're really good
them,
at mimicking behavior.
Totally. If you show them how to do it, they would totally do it. They wanted to know what they would do completely spontaneously. Just, if this is in your environment, what do you do with it? Because they wanted to know what's there inherently, not what they were mimicking. Because there is a... Yeah. So there's kind of like the innate level, and then there's the cultural level. Like, you remember like the monkeys that learn how to clean potatoes from other monkeys?
Oh, they wash, right. Yeah, they wash in the salt
water. Yeah, they wash. And there's a culture of that. Like washing the... At some points, one of them figured it out somehow, and then the rest, it's all culture. So once that happens, then it's learned, you know, and you can't say what ability was sort of inherent or was sitting there. They want this, the purpose of the study was to figure out without any, you know, training at all, what would they do spontaneously?
The monkeys in India that steal stuff and then sell it back to the people they took it from.
Oh, they trade
amazing.
It back for food.
Yeah.
I love that. I love that.
And they learn what the high value items are.
Yeah, that's
awesome, man.
They know if they take cell phones, they get more food than if they take something else.
I love it.
That is incredible.
It is. It's remarkable.
All right, Evan, give me a quote.
We take kids in elementary school and teach them math is important. Junior high, math is important. High school, math is important. And then all of a sudden, as adults, for whatever reason in our culture, math disappears. It strikes me as odd that if math is so important, why are we hiding from it in our pop culture? And that was asked in an interview by Bill Amend, who's a cartoonist known for the comic strip Foxtrot. Do you guys remember Foxtrot?
Yeah.
I do. It was one of my favorites. Yeah. And definitely had a very geeky, nerdy science bend to it. And that is because Bill has a degree in physics.
Awesome, man.
So he parlayed his physics degree into his love for cartooning. And made that rare leap going from the world of academia over to cartooning and bringing certainly a lot of that flavor. If you're familiar with Foxtrot, I highly recommend it. Definitely the characters are, especially the youngest of the kids in the family, Jason, who's the brainiac. So much physics and math and things going on there. As far as the quote goes, I agree with him certainly to an extent. This interview that I saw at him in is about 8 or 9 years old. So there have been some improvements, I think, in pop culture in that time with mathematics, certainly, especially in the cartooning area. You know, we can point to certain shows that we love, Rick and Morty, among others, that have made those efforts to try to infuse more science into it. Phineas and Ferb, I think, is another one that does that as well. And there are other examples. But, you know, overall, I think his point in the broader sense is sort of correct in that it is taught all throughout schooling. It is made to be important. And then a lot of people do sort of fall out of practice with it. And you just would think, you know, how much better informed and better decisions might people be if they were to maintain their math skills, their math cred.
If they weren't innumerate.
It's a good way of putting it.
They didn't suffer from innumeracy.
It's a good book.
No, I agree. That's one of the things we talk about. That, you know, the people don't understand like basic statistics, and it leads to bad decision making.
Yes, it does.
Oh, yeah.
The entire gambling industry is based upon
numerous. Oh my gosh! Absolutely.
All right. Thanks, Evan.
Thank you.
And thank you all for joining me this week.
Sure, man. Anytime you need us, Steve.
And until next week, this is your Skeptic's Guide to the Universe. Skeptic's Guide to the Universe is produced by SGU Productions, dedicated to promoting science and critical thinking. For more information, visit us at theskepticsguide.org. Send your questions to info@theskepticsguide.org. And if you would like to support the show and all the work that we do, go to patreon.com/skepticsguide and consider becoming a patron and becoming part of the SGU community. Our listeners and supporters are what make SGU possible.